I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're going to start in Thailand, where there are reports that at least one person is dead, dozens injured in a series of explosions in Bangkok. Thousands have been protesting against Thailand's government. Today's violence follows the army crackdown earlier this month against these so-called red shirt protesters. That left more than two dozen dead. The BBC's Rachel Harvey is in Bangkok. Rachel, what is the situation like there?
Pretty tense at the moment, and it has been tense for the past 3 days. These explosions have occurred in an area where hundreds of soldiers have been deployed in the financial district of Bangkok. But just across a busy intersection there is where the start of the anti-government protesters' camp is. So it's been a very tense kind of front line, really, with both sides reinforcing their barricades. I was just down there a few hours ago, and the anti-government protesters have built up very high barricades now with crossed sharpened bamboo sticks and tires. And as I say, across the junction from them, there are soldiers with assault rifles trained on the protesters.
Well, some people have been following this in the last few weeks. For others, it's just, you know, been a picture in the paper. So remind us, who are the red shirts and what do they want?
The red shirts are people who are still loyal to the exiled Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat. Now, he was ousted in a military coup in 2006. Many of his supporters have never forgiven or forgotten that act. There are also within this loose coalition a lot of old left-wing activists who see an opportunity now for broader reform within Thailand. They've come together under this umbrella of the red shirts to demand that the current coalition government step down and hold fresh elections. Now, they say that the current government under the Prime Minister Abhisit Wechichiwa is illegitimate because it came to power through a parliamentary agreement, not via the ballot box. So the protesters say they want to go back and have their vote and have their votes recognised. But it has escalated beyond really just an argument over electoral timetables. This has become really a battle on the streets of Bangkok for the future of Thailand and what kind of democracy it wants to be.
Well, and meanwhile, Bangkok, Thailand, huge tourist destination. Now, we know these protests have been going on for some 6 weeks, so perhaps tourism has slowed down, but what is the impact on just the average person in the street?
The impact on tourism has been pretty sharp now. The first few weeks, both the stock market, the tourism industry, other businesses seemed pretty resilient to all this. It was all very peaceful and good-natured. Then the protesters moved their base camp from the old historic part of Bangkok to a big retail area in the center of the city where there are upmarket shopping malls, five-star hotels and restaurants, and they've pretty much locked that area down. So those hotels are now closed, those shops are now closed. Huge amounts of money are being lost by businesses, and that has forced the government to consider what action it should take, because this is now having a big economic impact, as well as, of course, the impact on just ordinary people trying to get to work. And that terrible bloodshed that you referred to on April the 10th, that ended up in running street battles with live fire going in both directions. The government has said it believes that what it calls terrorists have infiltrated the protest movement. The Prime Minister is holding an emergency meeting tonight with his security officials, so we wait to see what response there might be to this.
Well, meanwhile, there were hints of possible new talks between the protesters and the government, but then we understand some of the red shirt leaders made comments like we can't talk when there's a gun at our heads, and so the talks seem to be off. And you're reporting anti-red shirt protesters are planning to rally in Bangkok tomorrow. Are these truly Thai citizens, or is this anti-red shirt protest set up by the government?
I think it probably is genuine Thai citizens, although the government is broadly supported by that group that are threatening to come out on Friday. There is a rival group of protesters who are known as Yellow Shirts. The Yellow Shirts first came out onto the streets back in 2006 because they are vehemently opposed to Thaksin Shinawat, that Prime Minister I referred to earlier who was ousted in a military coup. They came back onto the streets again in 2008 to force the then government from power, or at least that was their aim. In fact, a court ruling did it for them because that government was also loosely allied to Mr. Thaksin. Thaksin. So this ongoing back and forth between rival political factions played out both in parliament and on the streets and actually in military barracks. This has been going on for more than 4 years now, and it is still going on and becoming increasingly bitter and, as we've seen now, increasingly violent.
This could be another dangerous day in Thailand tomorrow. The BBC's Rachel Harvey speaking to us from Bangkok. Rachel, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
We've probably noticed there's been a battle on the nonfiction bestseller list over whether God exists. Well, now there's a fictional take on that debate. Philosopher and MacArthur Genius Award winner Rebecca Goldstein's new novel is 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a Work of Fiction. It's a satire on academic life that also takes the intellectual quest seriously. At its center, a college professor, Cass Seltzer, who's written a runaway bestseller about being what, in the novel, Time magazine calls an atheist with a soul, one with respect for the rapture of religion. Critics are throwing word bouquets at the book, and Rebecca joins us to talk about it. Welcome.
Hi.
Words like dazzling writing, nonchalant brilliance. You are a MacArthur Genius Award winner. And this book is set right in high academia, where people say things like, this question of preserving our software reminds me of those ancient Judeo-Christian debates on whether an immaterial soul survived the death of the body or the body is resurrected when the Messiah comes. And this as they eat tapas. So first of all, tell us about that. Why this world of academia?
Oh, well, of course, it's the world I know very well. I've spent most of my life in academia. But when you want to write novels where people are thinking for a living and taking ideas very, very seriously, those types of people do tend to end up, not always, but very often in academia.
In this book, they are wildly brilliant, but also at times gas bags. So yes. What are you saying about academia?
Yes. Well, one of the themes of the book is that the religious impulse in both its life-affirming, expansive, transcendent, wonderful aspects, but also in its delusions and its myopic reality is deeply rooted in human nature, and it's so deeply rooted that it flows out into completely secular contexts. Any kind of small insular community has these various aspects of the religious community, religious experience. And academia, for me, demonstrates this very well. So there are these a character who's a kind of, you know, self-proclaimed prophet. There are his adoring disciples, his graduate students. And so this was also a cheeky way of trying to demonstrate this point.
Well, you're talking about Professor Clapper, as Ron Charles says in the Washington Post. He is the grotesque love child of Harold Bloom and Miss Jean Brodie.
I love that.
A messianic poet-prophet who moves himself to tears and, we would add, treats his students as his grad students as both pets at times and prison inmates at other times. And he takes one of those students, who's your character, Cass Seltzer, to an Orthodox Jewish community in upstate New York. So right away, we have two communities that, as you say, seem a lot alike, insular, both the insular grad school life that Cass had been living and the insular Orthodox Hasidic life.
Yes. Yeah. No, those two communities are playing off against one another. And it's not clear which one is the more deluded.
Well, and as you say, you're familiar with the academic community. We should point out your husband is a Harvard cognitive scientist, Steven Pinker. Mm-hmm. So you're very immersed in this area, but also familiar with the Jewish community. What are you saying about people who are torn between both? Because one character soon is, they discover in the Hasidic community, a genius, a child genius. He could be one of the great math minds of all times. Should he leave the cloistered Hasidic community and come to, you know, Harvard? Or will that bring him closer to science and further away from God? You know, is that a struggle you had?
Yes, I grew up in a very Orthodox community, not a Hasidic community, but a very Orthodox community, and actually went to an all-girls high school where we were not encouraged even to go on to college. We really were encouraged to get married right away and start producing babies. And the worst thing you could possibly study was philosophy. So even before I had graduated from that school, I used one of my summer vacations to take a course at Columbia in philosophy. So that was, you know, that was my way out. But it is something that I feel very keenly. Although philosophically, I reject religion. I think that religion is about so much more than just belief in God. That it's about community. It's about being moved by certain historical narratives. It's about self-identity within the group. It's about a place to bring all of your existential dilemmas. So I, like my character, Cass Seltzer, although I philosophically reject belief, I have the greatest sympathy for many of the impulses that bring people to a religious community.
Well, the story goes back and forth through time. We meet him already as a famous professor, but we go back to time where we see him as a grad student. And it's all set in this area where we have all these places of higher learning. You've got Harvard University. But you put him at Frankfurter University in
Weedham, Massachusetts.
We have a Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts. So why did you bother to
So that I could take liberties with it. When I name Harvard or when I name MIT, I have to be, you know, true to the fact. But the president of my Frankfurter University is nothing like the president of Brandeis University.
Well, we have to point out how clever, Frankfurter University instead of Brandeis University, both Supreme Court justices?
Yes. I actually took out some of my really lowbrow jokes.
You didn't take out enough, thankfully, because they're just wonderful. But how much are you poking fun at institutes of higher learning? I mean, what are you saying for the professors who have the highest places in the firmament? You know who they are. They're the ones who, you know, they make it to the cover of Time magazine. Well, actually, your husband.
Well, some of them are the real McCoy, like my husband.
Yeah.
I suppose I feel, you know, I feel torn about academia the way I do about religion, the way I do about romantic love, which I also make fun of. All of these contexts, because they're human and they're very special places for us to reveal the full sweep of human experience, reveal absurdity, because we can't avoid absurdity, but also transcendence.
That's philosopher Rebecca Goldstein. Her new novel, 36 Arguments for the Existence of God. Tell you what, let's tick through some of their arguments. We'll talk about them on the other side of the break. There are miracles, so there must be God. There are geniuses. There's consciousness, which must be the spark of the divine. There's a cosmos. Since nothing can cause itself, God must have caused the cosmos. To that last one, by the way, Rebecca replies, who caused God? There's the argument from personal purpose. Life must have a reason. Rebecca says, our actions have purposes, we don't. There's math. There's a leap of faith. There's also the upward moral curve to history argument. Man left to his own devices would surely have gone the other way. And then my favorite, there's the movie It's a Wonderful Life. People who are lost find their way. It must be God. It's not other people helping them. And Rebecca, again, through her character, debates all of this. She says sometimes we find our way because it just bubbles up from inside us. We don't give ourselves enough credit. We have inner resources, to which a believer, Rebecca might say, who gave us those? We're going to have more with Rebecca Goldstein. Also later today, science. It shows us Mars and a star called God's Eyes. The Hubble telescope turns 20. That's later. Back with Rebecca Goldstein, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
We're back with philosopher and novelist Rebecca Goldstein, her new novel, 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a Work of Fiction. The book's main character, college professor Cass Seltzer, writes a best-selling book that in the story, Time magazine says, is the only one from an atheist who also knows what it feels like to have once believed. They call him the atheist with a soul. His book has an appendix that lists these 36 rational and ecstatic arguments for God, which Cass then disputes. The appendix is, of course, really the work of Cass's creator, author Rebecca Goldstein. So, Rebecca, let's talk about some of these arguments. There's number 22. the argument from the consensus of mystics. So there's unanimity about what they experience. Ergo, there must be a God. I'm paraphrasing, of course. But Cass responds in part, well, they could all be deluded. Then there's number 17, the argument from altruism, the idea that people will often do kind things for others, even if that endangers their own survival. So it must be an outside force that makes them do this, God.
Mm-hmm.
And so how does Cass bat that back?
He has several ways of batting it back. One is to say that actually evolutionary psychology has provided some basis for explaining the tendencies toward altruism. If you sacrifice yourself for somebody who carries your genes, that's all the gene cares about. And he expands on that as well.
Yeah. Well, I guess my point is this isn't Cass's appendix. It's Rebecca Goldstein's. And I'm just wondering, you've said that you are not religious. But was this you working through debates about God? Or did you already have an opinion when you came in? Did it change?
Well, the appendix was really fun for me because that's where I could not be a novelist anymore, but just my training is in analytic philosophy. And so this is kind of what we do in analytic philosophy. We try to formalize arguments and then probe their weaknesses.
Was your faith and what you believe shaken at all while you were doing it? Changed?
No, it was shaken so very long ago. But when I read something quite similar, when I was a very young girl being brought up in a very orthodox house, I found my way to a book called The Story of Philosophy by Will Durant, which gave me a taste of the kind of intellectual ecstasy that I have Cass Seltzer going through at the end of the first chapter. And then I found my way to other writings, and particularly to Bertrand Russell. And he has an article called Why I Am Not a Christian that goes through four of the standard arguments for God's existence and knocks them down. And I was just fascinated by this when I read it as this young girl. And I thought, wow, what I thought of as such a weakness in myself, this inability to have faith, might in fact be some sort of strength. That from a kind of Bertrand Russell point of view, trying to provide rigorous grounds for one's beliefs and discarding them if those beliefs don't hold up is a strong thing, not a weak thing. And that really changed my point of view tremendously. And I wanted to do that, but in a much grander scale, to gather together more arguments than anybody ever has before. Also very emotional kind of arguments, like there's the argument from the intolerability of insignificance or the argument from perfect justice.
No, are these real?
No.
You made these up?
I made these up, yes. But they are real in the sense that I think that partly what motivate people emotionally to want to believe in God, the intolerability of feeling insignificant in this cosmos, is, I think, a very powerful motivation to believe in God. And I wanted to formalize them into premises and conclusion and probe the arguments.
The argument from the intolerability of insignificance is the 20th in the list. And how does Cass, bat that back? I mean, it is intolerable for some to think of living without God. So why is that not reason for God?
Well, the distinction between what's psychologically intolerable for us to believe and what, you know, is intolerable for existence itself, is what is, or what's inconceivable for existence itself, is these are two entirely different things. I think he calls this, you know, the fallacy from wishful thinking. The mere fact that we really want something to be true doesn't make it so. And so to bring those kinds of emotional motivations for belief in God out into the open, instead of it murking.
It's okay.
I just made up a new verb, lurking in the murk. So murking is, to me, you know, this is a step forward intellectually.
Well, you certainly signal in the title, in the subtitle, what your thinking is. Because the title, again, big letters here written in the sky and on the cover, 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, but then the subtitle down there, A Work of Fiction. So you signal what you think, but have you had people disappointed? They pick up a book they think is entitled 36 Arguments for the Existence of God and then realize the conclusion is that you don't believe there is one.
That's right, and that the arguments are themselves a work of fiction. Or as one ardent atheist said to me, did you also mean 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, comma, a work of fiction, that God is a work of fiction? Yes, there have been. That's why I keep insisting on every interview there's a subtitle here. I don't want to mislead people. But on my book tour, you know, and often it was just announced as 36 Origins for the Existence of God. And yes, there was, in particular in Philadelphia, I remember in the free library, there was a woman who was really exercised. And she said, "Are you really saying that you are an atheist? Are you using that word? I've never heard anybody say anything so terrible about themselves. Are you really proclaiming this about yourself?" And we ended up having, I thought, a very nice exchange, because I assured her that although I rejected the belief in God, I didn't reject morality, ethics. I'm not a moral relativist. And I also think that we, no matter if we're atheists or not, are capable of this grand, expansive, self-effacing, almost spiritual experience. That's a very Spinozistic emotion, a spiritual experience, a transcendent experience without a belief in a transcendent God.
And Spinoza is just one of many who makes an appearance in your book. That's philosopher Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein. Her book is 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a Work of Fiction. It's quite a read. Rebecca, thanks so much for talking to us about
it. Thank you so much, Robin.
The Comedy Central show South Park has been ridiculing celebrities for 13 years. Paris Hilton, Kanye West, Oprah, Mel Gibson. The show's 200th episode, they all get together, led by Tom Cruise, who wants to get the people of the fictional South Park to deliver the prophet Muhammad. Because as Cruise says, Muhammad is the only person on the planet you can't make fun of. Cruise wants to harness that power, but he has to convince his fellow ridiculees.
Jimmy Buffett, how would you like it if nobody could call your music drunken frat boy monkey garbage? I'd love it.
But if they can get Muhammad, they have to figure out a way to deliver him without showing his image, because many Muslims believe that to do so is to be punished by death.
How about like a big mascot outfit? One that covered him completely, head to toe, not even showing his eyes.
Muhammad, would that be okay?
Okay.
So they dress Muhammad in a big furry bear costume. An Islamic group called Revolution Muslim posted a message on its website warning South Park creators Trey Parker and Matt Stone that what they're doing is stupid and they will probably wind up like Theo van Gogh, a reference to the 2004 murder of the Dutch filmmaker because of his film that showed how some Islamic societies abuse Muslim women. Dave Itzkoff joins us. He reports on the culture desk of the New York Times. Dave, have Trey Parker or Matt Stone said anything about this threat?
No, they haven't commented, you know, since the threat was made or since these episodes have been broadcast, but they generally don't. They like their episodes to speak for themselves, and they usually feel that anything that they needed to say has been said in the show.
Well, in fact, they have portrayed Muhammad before in the program back in the summer of 2001. This is before 9/11. Jesus is at the headquarters of the Super Best Friends, and he introduces a character in the show, Stanley, to one of those best friends. Let's listen.
Stanley, I want you to meet some of the super best friends.
Buddha, with the powers of invisibility.
Muhammad, the Muslim prophet with the powers of flame.
Dave Itzkoff, Trey Parker and Matt Stone have commented on that image. They said, you know, nobody cared about that.
But as you mentioned, I mean, that was in the summer of 2001, and a lot has happened since. They tried to revisit that same issue in a pair of episodes that they ran in 2006. That was after the Danish newspaper Jyllands Posten published a series of cartoons satirizing the prophet Muhammad, and they weren't allowed to show a Muhammad character. They could only show a big black box that said censored and not the prophet himself.
Well, where do you see this going? Because, you know, you might think it's very funny material, but this is a very serious threat.
Yeah, it's hard to know where this is all going to end up. I mean, all I can say is what's happened in the last couple of days, that there was another episode of South Park broadcast last night that was continuing the story of the Prophet Muhammad character in his bear costume. In this episode, they didn't even show the character or say his name. The name of the character was bleeped out, and the character was covered up again by a censored box. Some of those bleeps were put in by the South Park producers. Others were put in by Comedy Central even after the South Park producers delivered the episode to them.
So has Comedy Central expressed any concern?
They are not commenting specifically on, you know, any actions that they're taking, you know, since this group made its remarks on its website.
Well, in a way, what South Park is doing with this is, you know, if you take out the offensive Muslim references, is kind of brilliant, because it seems as if they're casting Tom Cruise and friends who've been very angry about how they've been depicted on the show as the same as Muslim fundamentalists.
Well, the show certainly has a history of trying to, you know, push buttons and also push boundaries of free speech. And, you know, with this particular set of episodes, I mean, they've certainly waded right into, you know, a very nebulous area, and certainly one where, you know, they certainly have a point and they've certainly, you know, inflamed a lot of sensibilities as well.
That's Dave Itzkoff, a reporter on the Culture Desk of the New York Times, commenting on a threat against the creators of South Park for their depiction of the Prophet Muhammad on their animated show. Dave, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And we're going to leave you with a little more sound from that South Park episode featuring a vengeful Tom Cruise being upbraided by his fellow celebrities, including Rob Reiner, Billy Bob Thornton, Sally Struthers, Hillary Clinton, all of whom have been mocked by South Park.
Tom, what is up with this Muhammad thing? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, you said we were just suing South Park.
No, I said we were going to use South Park to make sure we never got ripped on again.
A scene from South Park will follow this story for you, but be back in 30 seconds with a look at the Hubble as it turns 20 here and now. Happy birthday, Hubble. The giant telescope has been orbiting the Earth for 20 years. It's controlled from a command center in Baltimore, Maryland, but it sends back otherwise unreachable images of moons, nebulae, supernovae, and a giant black hole. Much like the International Space Station, the Hubble telescope has needed repairs. It, in effect, got a pair of glasses once. And last May, astronaut John Grunsfeld, who's visited Hubble many times, spoke from space after completing the Hubble's final repair.
And on this mission, we tried some things that many people said was impossible. Fixing STIF, repairing ACS, achieving all the content that we have in this mission. We've achieved that, and we wish Hubble the very best.
As does Kelly Beatty. He's contributed to Sky and Telescope magazine. He joins us in the studio. Kelly, welcome as always.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And remind us of the expectations for Hubble when it was first launched. What were the hopes?
Boy, everything was riding on it. It was going to be astronomy's discovery machine, and that was 20 years ago in 1990. And not long after the launch, after it was safely in orbit, astronomers discovered that there was a big problem. The main mirror, the thing that collects all the light, had been made incorrectly. Imagine hiring a carpenter to make a door for you, and the ruler he uses is the wrong size, so the door ends up being the wrong size. And that's what happened to Hubble. It was a beautiful mirror in the wrong shape.
Well, it's even worse than a door. It made the entire house non-functioning because it couldn't take the picture. So that's when they had that sort of, they put glasses on it?
Literally, they went up. And of course, Hubble was designed to be repaired by shuttle astronauts. So this is a good thing. And on the first servicing mission, which came about in just a couple of years after launch, they removed one of the instruments that had been installed at launch and replaced it with essentially a pair of glasses that fixed all of the optical problems and allowed it to have those pinpoint images that we've come to know and love.
Well, but this was a very expensive repair. So this has been one of the debates about Hubble. You know, how much did it cost? What's the cost benefit? And how much did we get in return? Let's talk about some of the things that Hubble did see that people felt were worth the cost. Start with the black hole, dark matter. And be kind with us, Kelly, for those of us who still can't wrap our heads around this.
Sure. Okay, well, we live in a galaxy called the Milky Way, and there's a few hundred billion stars. But at the core of the Milky Way, the stars are packed very closely together. Astronomers thought that these stars would merge into a giant, to quote Ross Perot, a giant sucking black hole with hundreds of millions of times the mass of our sun, such that anything that came near it would get sucked in, never to be seen from or heard from again. Now, we can't see the black hole, so how do you know it's there? And what astronomers found using Hubble is that the gases and the stars very near the brink of no return are spinning around so quickly that the only explanation is one of these supermassive black holes. And we've come to find that they're actually very common in the hearts of most of the galaxies that we can see.
Is that because, I mean, it would seem that we have gravity and things, so things would pull towards us. But if they're pulling so quickly towards this thing, there must be something pulling them.
Well, the more mass you have, the more something weighs, the greater its gravity. So if you can imagine something with the mass of 100 billion times the sun, you're going to have such unimaginable gravity that nothing can escape, not even light.
Well, and I can't imagine these things. I was doing some reading and trying to imagine some of the other things that Hubble saw. A tower of light and gases that was 57 trillion miles tall. It's very hard to wrap our brains around some of these things.
Yeah, astronomers work with lots of zeros. And yeah, that particular image that you were talking about, called the Pillars of Creation, shows, as Hubble has done many times, stars giving clouds of gas and dust giving birth to stars, and in turn, stars giving birth to planets around them. I mean, Hubble has really given us a new insight on how planets form, how solar systems form around other stars.
Yeah, and one of the Hubble's great accomplishments, proving Einstein's theory of the Big Bang. I think it's so interesting. We began our program today with a conversation about faith and religion and the existence of God. And some people say, okay, there was a Big Bang, but what was before the Big Bang? But tell us just briefly what Hubble found.
So you need to think of Hubble as a time machine. The farther out in space you look, the longer it's taken that light to reach us. If you can go far enough out into space, you see light that is coming to us from very early in the history of the universe. When we do that, when Hubble looks as far back as it can, it sees galaxies that are just in the beginning of being formed. Now, those galaxies have been expanding out from the Big Bang in all directions ever since the universe began. And what we find is that rather than slowing down, gradually slowing down and maybe even coming back together, which was what we thought, say, in the 1980s, they're actually speeding up and going away faster than when they started. Einstein had a notion of this, and he came to call it the cosmological constant, something in space that counteracts gravity. And astronomers now think that this is a property of space itself, and they've come to call it dark energy. Think of it as anti-gravity that's literally pushing everything apart, so the universe is literally going to expand forever with no hope of ever coming back into a big splat.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're going to leave that at that. How long is Hubble going to last?
Well, you know, that repair mission that John Grunsfeld and his colleagues did last year about this time was an excellent one. And they replaced everything they possibly could within reason to extend Hubble's life. It could last another 5 years, another 10 years. We do know that this is the last repair. That was the last repair mission we're going to have. Once Hubble is done, a rocket's going to attach to it and drive it into the Pacific Ocean somewhere where it will harmlessly return to Earth.
Well, and there is another telescope set to launch in 2014, the James Webb Space Telescope. It's designed so that it won't require manual repairs. And if so, it'll be the first thing ever made by man that won't. I'd love to see that. But I guess the overall question is, would you think, I asked the cost-benefit question, do you think Hubble's been worth the cost? $10 billion to build, launch, and maintain?
It's hard to overestimate the effect that Hubble has had on astronomy. I mean, there have been thousands of papers, tens of thousands of pictures taken. And I know that that doesn't justify the cost in and of itself, but it has literally been astronomy's discovery machine. Even now, 20 years after its launch, 6 times more astronomers want to use it than can. It's what we call oversubscribed. Now, when the Webb telescope gets into space in a few years, the pressure will be off Hubble. And yes, Webb is designed not to be repaired by astronauts. But in a way, it's a very good thing that Hubble was, because had it not been the case, it wouldn't nearly have the capabilities it has now. Not one of the original instruments is still on board. They've all been replaced.
You got a couple seconds. Your favorite image?
Oh, it's the Hubble Deep Field, where we look far back to as early in the universe as we possibly could, only 800,000 years after the beginning of the universe. It's a splendid image.
Okay. Kelly Beatty contributed to Sky and Telescope magazine on the 20th birthday of the Hubble. Kelly, thanks as always.
My pleasure, Robin.
Okay, we're going to take a minute break. When we come back, The War in the Pacific, HBO's terrific miniseries, Here and Now. I've mentioned before that I'm the daughter of a Marine who lied about his age to go fight at Guadalcanal. He had little black and white photos with those scalloped edges showing terrible, terrible gore. He had nightmares. We heard he saw hand-to-hand combat, but other than that, we didn't hear much about the war in the Pacific. Now we're learning why. HBO's new 10-part miniseries, The Pacific, debuted last month. It tells of the brutal World War II Pacific campaign against the Japanese through the stories of three real-life members of the 1st Marine Division. Eugene Sledge was one of them. His father, a doctor, wanted to keep his son out of the war because of his heart murmur, but Eugene Sledge signs up anyway.
I'm enlisting tomorrow. I'd do it tonight if they were open.
Eugene.
I don't need your permission, Father. I haven't for some time.
The worst thing about treating those combat boys from the Great War wasn't that they had had their flesh torn. It was that they had had their souls torn out. I don't want to look in your eyes someday and see no spark, no love, no life.
The Pacific is based on the book of the same name by author Hugh Ambrose, son of the late historian Stephen Ambrose, whose book Band of Brothers told the story of the European theater. And Hugh joins us from WWNO in New Orleans. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, pleasure to talk to you. And, finally getting to hear these stories, but they're so hard to hear. If you could just, for people who haven't been following the series yet, what was different about the campaign in the Pacific from the campaign that your father's first book wrote about, Band of Brothers?
Yes, my father's book, Band of Brothers, follows one company, Easy Company, from the Normandy invasion to Hitler's Eagle's Nest in Germany. And in that war against the Nazis, one side was going to win and one side was going to lose. That is to say, when Germans were surrounded and ran out of ammo, they held up their hands, they put out a white flag, and they were captured. In the Pacific, we have this vast ocean of enmity. The Japanese were of such fanaticism that surrender would never occur. So what they would do if wounded, if surrounded, if out of bullets, is they would wait until an American approached and detonate their last grenade, killing themselves, but also as many Americans as they could take with them. So in this war against the Empire of Japan, one side was going to annihilate the other.
Well, in that way, it feels almost as if it's the kind of war we've come to see more recently with suicide bombers and people who don't follow sort of a sense of military rules.
Yes, I think there is a broad general parallel between Japanese soldiers and sailors that the Marines and the Army fought in the Pacific and Al-Qaeda, in the sense that it was a battle to the finish.
In your book, The Pacific, you follow five troops. The miniseries follows three. One of them is Sergeant John Bassalone. He became a war hero, but a begrudging one. Here's a scene where he gets the news that he's being honored, and at the time he's drunk and disheveled.
Stumbling around camp like the town's stiff is not acceptable behavior. Not anymore.
Can't help but notice I'm not alone in this, sir.
You are in one respect. You are about to be awarded the Medal of Honor. President Roosevelt found you worthy. Congratulations, old man. You're about to go where very few Marines have ever been.
Sergeant John Bassalone and his machine gunners were in the midst of a jungle with very little in the way of physical defenses to help them, and they ultimately were completely surrounded by the Japanese, and they stayed and continued to fight all night long until they were eventually reached by other Marines. And for that, he was awarded the Medal of Honor. He was the first living enlisted Marine to receive it, and thus received a great deal of attention for his act of heroism.
Well, he did. But why do you think so much of the Pacific was forgotten? Why don't we know more about the battles of the Pacific?
I think there are a lot of reasons for that. We know more about the European theater because many people's parents emigrated from Europe. We know more about the European theater because Germany, Nazi Germany, was a greater threat to the progress of human civilization than Japan. But we also know more about the European theater because the guys out there, particularly late in the war, on places like Peleliu and Okinawa in the Pacific, were fighting a war that didn't make any sense to them anymore. Because Japan was beaten militarily. Strategically, the war was over. Japan could not win. And here they were fighting these battles to the death.
Well, then, did the Marines who fought in the Pacific, did they think that what they did maybe wasn't as important as the guys who stormed Normandy?
the Marines and the soldiers who fought in the Pacific knew that what they were doing is important, and they knew what kind of empire Japan was creating and the kind of atrocities it practiced upon the areas that it conquered. I just simply think that the violence got to be so all-encompassing that these young men were deeply affected by it. You, as a young Marine, are on Okinawa and you're finishing the battle, and men are still climbing out of caves, having hid for weeks to come out with a pistol in the last few rounds in the chamber to try to kill a few more Marines. This makes no sense at all, right? There's nothing to be gained by this. This is just killing for the sake of killing. And I think it scared them very deeply.
You included two additional troops in your book that aren't in the film. There's Vernon, a dive bomber pilot, and Austin, a prisoner of war. What was important about their stories that you wanted to tell?
The book opens with Austin Schaffner, a lieutenant in the Philippines. By being in the Philippines and understanding what the Japanese troops did to the Filipinos, you get a clear sense of why America has to win this war. We also, with Austin Schaffner, understand that he had recently come from China with his 4th Marine Regiment. So I wanted people to understand the planes that arrive over Pearl Harbor did not arrive out of a blue sky, that there was a lot going on, and that the young men who were serving in the Pacific knew that war would come any day and were preparing for it. I have a Navy pilot in there, Mike Mikeel, because the front line of America's war against Japan were the carriers and the naval aviators who went after the Japanese fleet. And Mike sees more carrier battles than just about anyone I've ever met.
Well, Hugh Ambrose, today we tend to think that vets returning from war and having problems reintegrating the society is kind of a new thing. But we've been seeing that's not true, and children of veterans who returned from World War II grew up knowing that that wasn't true. But you remind us with Eugene Sledge that it's definitely not true. How was he changed when he came back?
Well, Eugene Sledge begins, like many young men, believing that combat will make him a man. What he realizes is that the hardened look of a combat veteran, the stare, doesn't come immediately from confidence. In a lot of ways, for Eugene Sledge, that stare, that hardened look, came from loss, from the inability to care about most of the problems that civilians encounter. And he began to understand that combat takes away from the young men, and now young women, who step into harm's way. I, as a young man in the 1970s and 80s, watched many films about the war in Vietnam, and I was left to assume, as I think many of my generation did, that Vietnam was bad because all these terrible things happened, and some of those things were perpetrated by Americans. In the Pacific, what we come to understand is there is no such thing as a good war. There is only the necessary war. Because this is what happens when young men go onto the battlefield. This is the cost that we pay. And I think we should always understand that as parents and as voters, that when America is going to project military power, it had better be for a very good reason.
That's Hugh Ambrose. His book is called The Pacific. It was used as the basis for the HBO miniseries of the same name. Hugh, thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you for having me on, Robin.